The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Trains, subways, planes, where you have lots of people potentially crowded together for long periods of time, with or without good ventilation. Maybe they're wearing masks, maybe they're not. Why are people allowed to crowd into buses, trains, and planes if that's mandatory 6-foot distancing? Well, you might say because it's really, really important for people to be able to travel and willing to tolerate that risk. When a governor says something's essential, what they mean is it's important. And what I think Justice Kavanaugh articulated, and I think the majority adopted quietly, they didn't say so, but they adopted, is governors can't say religion's unimportant. So if you say certain types of gatherings are important, doesn't matter what kind they are, then by definition, by a matter of law, you must treat the exercise of religion as favorably.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 4th, 2020. In a ruling late in the night, the day before Thanksgiving, the Supreme Court issued a preliminary injunction against Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York, preventing him from imposing restrictions on how many people could attend houses of worship, restrictions that Governor Cuomo defended as necessary to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. In a lawsuit brought by a Catholic diocese and an organization of Orthodox Jews, a majority of the court held that the occupancy restrictions had a high likelihood of violating the free exercise of religion, as protected by the First Amendment. To help explain that decision and to discuss its implications for future public health responses to COVID, I'm joined by law professors Lindsay Wiley of American University and Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 4th. Lindsay Wiley and Josh Blackman on the Supreme Court's recent decision, Roman Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn versus Andrew M. Cuomo, Governor of New York. Lindsay, let me start with you. What were the New York restrictions at issue in this case?
So it takes a little time to dig in and figure out exactly what restrictions were in place that were being challenged here, because the restrictions have varied quite a bit from place to place and time to time throughout the last several months. But the basic framework that the Supreme Court was addressing was set forth by Governor Cuomo in an October 6th executive order. This is where Cuomo launched what he called a micro-cluster strategy, really micro-level targeting at the zip code level, which, as you know, is quite small in New York City, of restrictions. The version of the restrictions in effect at this point were based on test positivity rates and rolling 7-day averages of cases, reported cases per 100,000 population. And they divided geographic areas into red, orange, and yellow zones based on those indicators. The key restrictions that were being challenged were in the orange and red zones. In the orange zone, the basic restrictions were that worship services or houses of worship were capped at 33% of capacity or 25 people, whichever was lower. And at the same time, because, you know, the key issue in this case is comparing those restrictions to other restrictions on secular settings, other gatherings were capped at a lower level at 10 people maximum, whether indoor or outdoor. Businesses in the orange zones were closed if they were designated as high risk and non-essential. That includes gyms, personal care services, as well as indoor dining and bars. So outdoor dining only, 4-person maximum per table, and also schools were designated to switch to remote only. in the red zone under the same order, those restrictions were tightened or, you know, dialed up to further decrease social mixing and interaction. In a red zone, worship services were capped at either 25% capacity or 10 people, whichever was smaller. All gatherings are prohibited in a red zone of any size, whether indoor or outdoor. And businesses are ordered to close unless they are deemed essential. Dining is restricted to takeout only, so outdoor dining closes when you move from orange to red, and schools remain remote only. One key change that came after the October 6th order, at the end of October, Governor Cuomo announced a plan that would permit but not require school districts to reopen if they satisfied some pretty stringent testing requirements, really requiring weekly testing of teachers and staff. And that may have been an important point in terms of the comparison between schools and worship services, given that the risks are somewhat similar there. That came later in October, however.
So Josh, let me turn to you. So as Lindsay points out, this is an incredibly detailed and kind of comprehensive scheme. And so I was hoping you could comment on that and, you know, perhaps why New York decided to regulate at such a high level of granularity. And then what the specific implications of that was for the houses of worship in these orange and red zones.
Sure. And thank you so much for having me. I'm a fan of the podcast. At the outset, I should disclose that I'm actually not just a professor, I'm also an attorney in this case. I represented a Jewish school in Queens, Beis Yaakov Ateris Miriam, that was subject to these restrictions, and that case is ongoing. The governor's orders came out of the blue. Earlier, the New York City mayor, de Blasio, had imposed this zip code-wide prohibition on certain meeting places. And then in this sort of tiff between the mayor and the governor had to one-up him and said, well, we're going to do better than zip codes. We'll do these microclusters, which were these sort of block-by-block bases where you could be maybe on one side of the street and be in zone red or zone orange. And if you cross the street, you're based in zone yellow or zone nothing at all. I think a lot of these drawings were close to arbitrary. We don't know why they drew them the way they did. There were some neighborhoods where there was no orange. You went straight from red to yellow. There was no buffer zone. And it was premised on the idea that people don't cross the street, right? That if, you know, if you have a person going to a store on one side of the street, he will not dare cross the street to the other side. You know, I respect the governor's interest in clamping things down, but these were always plagued from the beginning just from a logistical standpoint. But for our purposes here, the orders impose specific restrictions on both houses of worship and schools, which Lindsay mentioned a few moments ago. Almost immediately after the order was announced, the Brooklyn Diocese challenged it. Agudath Israel, which is an organization of synagogues, challenged the order. And myself, I'm one of the attorneys who brought a lawsuit on behalf of a Jewish school. One of the frustrations of this litigation is what I call the game of whack-a-mole, where at the last minute, the governor changes the policy to avoid an adverse court judgment. So, for example, we had filed a motion for a temporary restraining order. The night before Cuomo's response was due, he magically decided to lift the restrictions in our school. Right, our neighborhood went from orange to yellow overnight, and there wasn't really a droppage in the positive rate, which again makes me very skeptical of the entire process. A similar thing happened with the Agudath Israel case and the diocese case. On the eve of when Cuomo's brief was due to the Supreme Court, magically all the orange neighborhoods were eliminated. There's only yellow subject to this case. So I think their efforts try to moot the litigation, which makes it tough. And I think that explains why the court fragmented 5-4 instead of 6-3, which we can get into. But it's a very hard thing to challenge when these rules change so frequently without any real rationale of why they're changing. But at any point, the restrictions can be snapped back into place.
So let's turn to that issue and talk about the opinion itself. So the opinion is basically, I think you can divide it into two parts. The first is this interesting procedural discussion about whether or not it is appropriate, given the posture of the case, for the Supreme Court to issue an injunction at the time that it did. And then the second half, and the one that I suspect is going to be particularly important going forward, is about the actual merits, the First Amendment claims at issue. Josh, since I know you've written a lot about this, can you walk us through, and you've done so a little bit already, but just walk us through what the kind of procedural issue here and this debate between the majority and in particular the Chief Justice, who dissents, on the appropriateness of injunctive relief?
Right. So there are two issues to think about. One, whether it would have been appropriate for the district court to issue an injunction. And second, whether at this point in time it was appropriate for the Supreme Court to issue an injunction. I think given how five or six justices thought about the merits, the district court probably erred in not granting an injunction. But that wasn't the question here. The question is, at this juncture, now that the orange zones have been basically eliminated, or at least temporarily eliminated, should the court proceed? The majority basically said, let's go forward. And this is a position that I developed on a few blog posts. In the law, there's something called mootness. Okay, what's mootness? If a controversy is no longer live, the courts usually don't decide it. But there are some exceptions to mootness doctrine. One of the most famous ones is called, it's a mouthful, capable of repetition yet evading review. Capable of repetition yet evading review. The easiest example of this is an abortion case. A pregnancy lasts no more than 9 months. To litigate an abortion a challenge will take more than 9 months. So by the time, let's say, Roe v. Wade gets to the Supreme Court, the pregnancy is no longer active, right? For whatever reason, more than 9 months have passed. So the courts have said, if there's some controversy that evades review, but it can repeat over and over again, we'll keep the case. There's another doctrine called voluntary cessation, which means if the government voluntarily stop enforcing some bad policy, but there's a chance they might reenact it later, the courts also keep the case. So the court has used two doctrines. And I think the Supreme Court hinted at both of these. They didn't really say which one, but they kind of hinted at both of these doctrines. Said, look, we know that at this present moment, New York doesn't have any orange zone synagogues, any orange zone churches that are plaintiffs, but this can change quickly. And indeed, Governor Cuomo has said basically all of New York City may snap to orange any minute now. So it makes no sense to avoid these questions because at any minute, the controversy will become live again. And I suspect that the court was worried that the second they ruled, Cuomo would just snap back to orange and just undo the entire case. The dissenters vigorously disagreed. So the Chief Justice rejected the entire notion of entering an injunction here. The Chief Justice said, why are we jumping out ahead of this when there's no one subject to it? In other words, we're not telling the government to do anything he's not doing. All we're doing here is simply issuing a meaningless injunction. Justice Breyer in dissent made a similar point. Breyer said, well, if Cuomo reenacts these orders, let them come back to the court. The majority said, well, that's very reassuring, but it takes sometimes days and perhaps weeks to get Supreme Court review. The court doesn't intervene in a matter of minutes. And then there are going to be Sunday masses and Saturday Shabbat services and different things that just will not happen in the interim. This case has gone on for a month. And if I can just point a personal privilege, litigating this case has been very frustrating. And I recognize there are a lot of equities on all sides, but it's been a consistent pattern at every level of COVID litigation that when a case gets to the high court, their efforts to moot it, it happens over and over again. These governors are not stupid. Cuomo is an attorney general. He's a smart dude, right? He knows what he's doing, right? His attorney general is a very smart person. She knows what she's doing. I'm not alleging maliciousness. I'm simply saying that the mootness doctrine has exceptions. And I think this is a very good place to use these exceptions in light of this litigation.
In terms of the sort of injunctive relief, though, that the court has granted, what is to stop now that an injunction has been granted against this particular policy? What is to stop Governor Cuomo from tweaking it slightly, right? Instead of going from orange to red, he goes to green and blue and changes the occupancy amounts. I mean, doesn't this still allow him some wiggle room, or is the injunction sort of broader than simply the issue or the restriction that he originally imposed and then lifted at the very end?
Oh, this is a very narrow injunction. All the court said is pending this current appeal, the 10-person cap and the 25-person cap can't be enforced. That's all it says. Indeed, it isn't clear that this injunction extends beyond the named plaintiffs. This is an issue of which your listeners are familiar with, the issue of the nationwide injunction. Here, there's no statewide injunction. This didn't apply to the entire state. It was to the named plaintiffs. And trust me, I know this because I think it are, you know, other cases that sued will have to bring additional claims. So this is a very narrow injunction. I mean, I know this is seem like a big loss for Cuomo, but this can be evaded very quickly. He can just modify the policy altogether and start something new and have to wait to be sued. It's this game of whack-a-mole that never ends.
So then presumably the long-term importance of this case is then about what the court is saying, or at least signaling about its views on the First Amendment and how they will apply to future restrictions. So let's turn to that next. And let me ask you, Lindsay, you know, why is it that the majority of the court thought that there was a high likelihood that the New York order violated the First Amendment? And then, you know, why did at least some of the dissenters disagree with that?
Well, I think the basic issue, of course, is whether these orders discriminate on the basis of religion or alternatively satisfy the minimum requirement of neutrality to religion. To understand what changed in this case, at least with respect to what is on the table and potentially off the table for executive orders going forward, I think it's important to go back to the court's earlier pronouncements on restrictions on religious worship services during the pandemic. Chief Justice Roberts had kind of set forth a framework for assessing whether restrictions were discriminatory in South Bay that the majority here rejects. And that Roberts' approach was to compare restrictions on houses of worship to restrictions on secular settings that he deemed similar in terms of the risks that were presented. So South Bay was a similar case, but arising out of California's restriction on worship services. Roberts said that was not discriminatory so long as similar secular settings, and he used theaters, concerts as examples, were subject to restrictions that were the same or less strict for churches than for those similar settings. Roberts in South Bay expressly rejected Kavanaugh's assessment that non-essential businesses or essential businesses, sort of in and out retail shopping, was the right comparator here. So Roberts said that retail stores really do not present similar risks because people are gathered there only for a snapshot moment in time. They're moving in and out. They're not spending significant amounts of time, a sustained time together, the way that they are in church services, synagogue services, or in theaters or concerts. Kavanaugh in South Bay had adopted the same line that some lower court judges had. The most famous and clever summary of that was, if beer is essential, so is Easter, from the Kentucky cases early in the pandemic, seeking to reopen church services before Easter at a time when liquor stores had been deemed essential. So that was kind of a favorite characterization of the seemingly arbitrary nature of these rules. So in Roman Catholic diocese, the majority expressly rejects Roberts's framing of the right comparators being higher risk secular settings. Instead, they appear to adopt Kavanaugh's earlier description of retail stores as the right comparators. They also mention schools, which I think are a more appropriate comparison in terms of the time spent indoors together. I think the other key way of understanding what's happening in this majority opinion is that these orders draw two different types of distinctions, the orders that we've seen in New York and elsewhere. There's a distinction between essential businesses and non-essential businesses. That really comes into play when most things are closed and an exception is made for some services based on their priority, not based on the fact that they're low risk, but based on the idea that they are essential or life-sustaining. The other distinction that comes into play is at a time when most things are open and some things are closed based on being higher risk. So that's not based on priority, it's based on risk. The tricky thing here is that the court was grappling with both scenarios simultaneously. So the orange zone restrictions are a situation where most things are open unless they are high risk. The red zone restrictions are a situation where most things are closed unless they are high priority. I understand the majority's opinion here to be saying that if anything is open based on priority, based on, you know, its designation as essential, the restrictions on churches can be no stricter than on those essential services. They frame that in terms of the risks, in terms of the idea that a grocery store, for example, poses the same risk, or a factory or a school poses the same risk as churches. But I think in terms of the implications for public health orders going forward, it seems to create something similar to a kind of most favored nation status requirement for religious purposes, that they must be deemed essential. So long as essential settings are open, then religious services must be allowed to proceed with the same level of restrictions that are in place for those essential retail stores, for example.
So the thing that I have been struggling with in reading this opinion and reading the other cases about COVID restrictions and religious institutions is I can't figure out how one goes about identifying the right comparator, at least not in a kind of a non-arbitrary way. So presumably if the government shut down everything, if we went into the sort of incredibly broad lockdown that we had at the beginning of the pandemic, we wouldn't really be having these debates, right? The government can shut everything down, including, if necessary, houses of worship, in order to at least on a temporary basis, to stop COVID. And then on the other hand, if the government leaves everything open and only shuts down houses of worship, then obviously, you know, the comparator is clear. You're just comparing it to everything else. And what it seems to me in reading this opinion is that the majority and the dissent are talking past each other, at least somewhat, in part because they're picking different relevant comparators, right? So the majority wants to compare the treatment of religious institutions to grocery stores, and the dissent wants to compare the treatment of religious institutions to lecture halls and concert halls and so forth. And so that choice of comparator, either of which strike me as plausible, depending on what you are trying to emphasize, seem to drive the conclusion on the merits. And so my question for you, Lindsay, and also for you, Josh, you know, is there some non-arbitrary way of determining what the proper comparator is?
There is, but it's a nuanced thing, and it's tricky to communicate. And actually, I think one of the problems throughout the last several months is that elected officials, governors and mayors, have not always been best equipped to communicate the nuance here. We need to hear from health officials who really understand the epidemiological data. And sometimes it's been misrepresented innocently, perhaps, by elected officials who don't fully understand it. The epidemiological evidence, and this really comes from investigations, more than just contact tracing, more than just asking people where they've been, but really tracing where can we pinpoint that transmission is happening. Those epidemiological investigations pointed to a few key factors in terms of increasing the risk. And we're talking about risk, not just at the individual level, not at the level of, you know, what one person might do that increases their chance of contracting the infection, but at the population level, what is the risk that allowing any given event or interaction to happen will drive an increase in community transmission and spread at the population level? Those factors include being indoors, which is much less safe than being outdoors. They include people from multiple households gathering indoors. So, you know, even personal services like a haircut might not pose the same risk of community spread if it's only the client and the stylist. So multiple households indoors, and then time, duration is a key factor to consider. So early in the pandemic, it emerged that an hour seemed to be a kind of key tipping point in terms of the risk that multiple people in a gathering indoors would contract the infection because of that interaction. Now, the real controversy comes in deciding whether spending an hour or more indoors is safe if you're 6 feet apart and in masks. There's certainly evidence indicating that 6 feet apart and in masks may not be enough if you're spending sustained time indoors in a poorly ventilated, you know, indoor space. And so with all of those factors in mind, the identification of higher risk settings, which might be subject to stricter limits even when non-essential businesses are permitted to open because they're deemed lower risk, is that these are places that, you know, in pre-pandemic plans, we would just call indoor gathering places. You know, a grocery store isn't thought of as a gathering place in the same way that a restaurant or a synagogue or a school might be. And so those are the kind of factors that have come into play. That epidemiological investigation evidence was submitted to the court in amicus briefs and by the state. And the dissent pointed to the idea that the majority disregarded that evidence and instead substituted its own assessment that, you know, it just didn't make sense to the majority that 200 people could be in a retail store at any given moment in time. And that seemed to the majority to be as risky as permitting or riskier than permitting a smaller number of people to gather while talking and singing and staying stationary for an hour or more.
Thanks, Lindsay. I think I could just add a few points. Justice Kavanaugh's dissent, I think, proved influential. That is his dissent in Calvary Chapel. And he said that the free exercise of religion ought to be considered a most favored right. And what that means is the burden becomes more difficult for the state to justify any disparate treatment. So let's take an example that people may not like to think about, but maybe trains, you know, subways, planes, where you have lots of people potentially crowded together for long periods of time with or without good ventilation. Maybe they're wearing masks, maybe they're not. Why are people allowed to crowd into buses, trains, and planes that's mandatory 6-foot distancing? Well, you might say because it's really, really important for people to be able to travel and willing to tolerate that risk, right? When a governor says something's essential, what they mean is it's important to me. And what I think Justice Kavanaugh articulated, and I think the majority adopted quietly, they didn't say so, but they adopted, is governors can't say religion's unimportant. So if you say certain types of gatherings are important, doesn't matter what kind they are, then by definition, by a matter of law, you must treat the exercise of religion as favorably. And the key move is it's the burden of the governor to show why one is important and one isn't. And that's going to be a very hard comparison to make. I'm not an epidemiologist, and I don't pretend to be. I would like just to put a couple of facts out there. The houses of worship we were talking about in New York can fit to 1,000 people, and they were limited to 10. The Diocese of Brooklyn banned singing. Can you imagine going to a church where singing is prohibited? They arranged their entry and exiting to ensure that people were distanced. They took every precaution imaginable, and still they've had, you know, no outbreaks in these houses of worship. They've been very careful. There have been some houses of worship that have not been careful, and I'm not defending them all. The school that I represented in New York had zero COVID cases. They had testing. They kept people separated in pods. They had temperature checks. They had mandatory quarantines if anyone was infected at home. Houses of worship can take these measures to safeguard themselves. In fact, they did it so voluntarily. But the court's ruling here is that you cannot just presume that houses of worship will be reckless, that they'll sit there screaming with their masks off and you know just behaving. Going forward, the governor's going to be very careful of simply assuming the houses of worship have to be treated in this different fashion.
So I think that that's a really important point that Josh just made. And I think that the New York orders are problematic. I think, as he points out, right, a capacity limit based on percentage of occupancy may have been a far more rational way to approach this than a hard limit on numbers. I just want to jump in on the point of importantness. I think just like risk, importantness has to be a spectrum. So, you know, at an extreme situation, no matter how much we want to restrict everything, as Alan put it, you know, close everything, that's just not possible. Hospitals would have to stay open, right? Nursing homes would have to stay open. Various services that are life-sustaining would have to stay open. And that's not based on the fact that they're low risk. It's based on the fact that they're important. The question in my mind after this decision is, if a state were to significantly restrict what qualified as essential, would churches and synagogues and other houses of worship still have to be treated as favorably as even the most important setting? So say hospitals, for example, because we simply cannot impose capacity limits on hospitals. And so at a certain point, there has to be a line that we permit state and local governments to cross where churches may be treated as favorably as, say, schools or indoor dining, but not necessarily as favorably as hospitals, which can't be subject to restrictions because they are so important.
So this then, I think, leads us to the question of what this case means going forward. So the posture of this case is that this is a request for injunctive relief, and the court is very careful not to render a decision on the merits. It even says in the per curiam opinion, we're not going to provide a lot of reasoning here because we just need to get this decision out quickly. And then if necessary, we will deal with this on a cert petition if it comes through the Second Circuit. And there are lots of ways we can imagine trying to reconstruct the doctrine. But I do want to spend some time sort of thinking about what this does mean for the future. And Josh, I want to ask you the first question here. Now, you've written a lot, and I think really interestingly, about what this decision says about the Supreme Court generally as an institution. So putting aside for a second the question of the First Amendment or COVID restrictions, you've talked about this case as the day when, and I'm quoting here from a recent blog post of yours, the new Roberts Court has arrived. And what do you mean by that, especially since, the Chief Justice was in dissent in this case?
It's often said that every new member of the court creates a new court. The moment that Justice Ginsburg was replaced by Justice Barrett created a new Roberts Court. And I think this is a significant change. In 2018, Justice Kennedy retired. For almost a decade, Justice Kennedy was the swing vote, right? In every case, the outcome really turned to what Justice Kennedy thought of, that, you know, every major case, he was a deciding vote. There were exceptions, but it was usually him. And for a period of almost 2 years, Chief Justice Roberts was king in cases involving the DACA rescission, involving the U.S. Census, involving a lot of other cases where he would kind of swing left, swing right, go in the middle. And he really could decide the fate of the court. It was reported that John Roberts didn't want to take any Second Amendment cases, so the court denied all the Second Amendment cases. He was really in charge. In South Bay, the case Lindsay mentioned a few moments ago, Roberts wrote this concurrence. It wasn't a majority opinion. It was a solo concurrence. That solo concurrence more or less defined the state of COVID litigation. By my count, and again, my count's perhaps not accurate, but this is my count, in 6 months, Roberts' opinion was cited more than 100 times, 114 times to be precise, right? Every single COVID litigation referred to John Roberts' opinion. And it didn't have to involve free exercise. It can involve voting rights. It can involve conditions for prisoners. It can involve Fourth Amendment. It can involve gun rights. Anything COVID-related, they say, South Bay. And it was a complete mistake. Roberts' opinion was so narrow. It was about whether the Supreme Court should grant an injunction pending appeal. He mentioned Jacobson, a case which both Lindsay and I have written quite a bit about, but it wasn't an endorsement of Jacobson. And lower courts, I think, mistakenly treated Roberts' solo concurrence as the gospel. Why? Because he was the man, right? He was the guy in the middle who decided the case. No mas, right? No more. He's in dissent. And the second I read them, I'm like, okay, we're done. South Bay had a good run. It's over. And in fact, it was a Sixth Circuit decision a couple days ago where the panel said, we don't rely on Jacobson, we don't rely on South Bay. Wow, right? Is that all it took? Is that it? So South Bay is done. It had a good run, had a good six-month run, and it's toast. At this point, I think the Kavanaugh concurrence is probably what people are going to be citing the most, unless the court takes another case in the near future. Now, keep in mind, I don't think John Roberts is some sort of squishy liberal. I don't think that for a second. I'm sure he would probably rule for the diocese in a normal case, but he doesn't like granting injunctions. Now, if another case comes to the court on certiorari that is not on an emergency appeal, I think Roberts will write the majority opinion. And you say, look, see, I'm being consistent. But for at least now, Roberts was marginalized. And there was some pretty bitter language between Roberts and Gorsuch. I'm happy to talk about it. Maybe Lindsay can. But there was some pretty bitter back and forth between the chief and Justice Gorsuch. They were not on good terms. Gorsuch accused Roberts of basically abdicating. And Roberts like, don't blame me. I'm just denying an injunction. Just I didn't do that much. Don't read so much into what I wrote in South Bay, which is just stunning in light of how much that opinion has meant for the last 6 months of our lives.
And do you think in particular that this sidelining, as you've described it, of the Chief Justice is going to be limited primarily to COVID cases, or that in some fundamental way, the Chief Justice is no longer running the show? And of course, Chief Justices don't necessarily ever run the show, right? Ultimately, it's whoever can get to five votes. But it is striking that the Chief Justice was really out kind of on his own and was, as you point out, subject to some quite withering, and you know, at least by the standards of what we read in Supreme Court opinions, quite withering and I thought mocking treatment fairly junior justice.
I think Gorsuch crossed the line. Again, I'm not a Roberts fan. I criticize him heavily, but I, I think Gorsuch was short-sighted. The chief will be here for a long time unless he takes my advice and retires, but I think he'll be here for a long time. But let me make this point more broadly. Historically, chief justices have not been in dissent, right? I've gone back and done research. Maybe Lindsay has other insights, but I can't think of a chief justice who was consistently in dissent, right? Chiefs have found a way to be in the majority. So John Roberts has two choices. He can either be in dissent all the time, or he can find a way to be in the majority. But the problem is, if he tries to write a majority opinion that's too narrow, he can lose his right flank, and he'll just have to concur in judgment. So I don't know which way John Roberts moderates. I think his time is past him. I mean, now, if there's a vacancy that arises and something happens to Justice Thomas, he's back as a king. But for at least the next period of time, I don't know what he does to keep himself relevant. I really don't know. Maybe he doesn't know either. He wasn't expecting this. He thought he was at the top of the castle after this term with the DACA case and the census case and all these other decisions. But now just he's got to be looking at himself like, what am I going to do? And I think he'll find a way to moderate to the right. I think he was boxed in on the COVID issue, but I think he'll find a way to move forward.
So Lindsay, let me turn back to you and let's talk about what this case means going forward for public health measures. As you point out, it's not entirely clear what the First Amendment law is after this case, and it's not clear how literally to take Justice Kavanaugh's position that a house of worship always has to get the most favored treatment, let's say, among epidemiologically similarly situated institutions, because as you point out, right, at some point we have to, or presumably at some point, there has to be the ability to close down everything but hospitals. And so how do you expect this to play out, especially over the next several months? We have a vaccine hopefully coming in the spring, and hopefully that will bring this pandemic to a relatively quick finish. But certainly over the next several months, as we have incredible spread and pretty unpleasant winter, this is going to be a serious problem. So, I mean, what will this opinion mean for the flexibility of public health agencies and governors around the country, and maybe even the Biden administration, to the extent that it wants to do some early moves on this to stop the spread of COVID?
So I'll start with restrictions on houses of worship and gatherings for religious purposes. I fully expect state and local jurisdictions, even as they tighten restrictions on other settings and on private gatherings for other purposes, to take a very hands-off approach to religion going forward after this decision. I think getting tied up in court battles is not something state and local officials are particularly eager to do. They've got plenty of that on their hands as it is. And if Roberts's approach in South Bay doesn't work to impose some level of restrictions that are more stringent than, if nothing else, on hospitals, then it's hard to figure out what does. I think it's possible that you could move forward with restrictions that are no more stringent than for grocery stores. And it may be that the court would ultimately come up with some kind of principle for drawing a line about priority. But the majority's approach suggests that even if restrictions are no more stringent than they are for settings that pose similar risks, that doesn't seem to work under the majority's analysis, because they deemed retail stores to be similar in terms of risk, even though the evidence suggests otherwise. Beyond the First Amendment, I think a big question here, and this was really, I think, at the heart of the bitter exchange between Roberts and Gorsuch, is the role of Jacobson. Jacobson has been interpreted in a really odd way for someone who, like me, has studied public health law, and Jacobson is very much at the heart of that for a long time. It's been somewhat bizarre to see the Fifth Circuit's interpretation of Jacobson and In re Abbott back in May just absolutely catch on like wildfire. And I refer to that as the Jacobson suspension doctrine, which I see as distinct from understanding Jacobson to have any kind of lesson that remains valid today.
And let me jump in just for a second for those of our readers or those of our listeners rather who may not have heard of Jacobson. If you could just give a little bit of background, it's this old 1905 case about compulsory vaccination, and it's kind of oft cited but rarely read. So if you could just provide a little bit more background on Jacobson.
Sure. So Jacobson is certainly having its moment this year. The way we taught Jacobson before 2020 was that it articulated in very strong terms that the common good, that public health, even public safety, could outweigh individual rights in any given circumstance, but particularly in a public health crisis. I didn't teach Jacobson as any kind of emergency standard of review. I'm not aware of anyone who had interpreted it that way before 2020, when the Fifth Circuit, in a case challenging restrictions on abortion as elective procedures that were restricted in many states at the time, the Fifth Circuit interpreted Jacobson to somehow pre-commit the courts to reverting to, you know, this 1905 standard of review, regardless of what the individual right or fundamental right at issue may be, that you know, the courts were supposed to revert to an arbitrary and capricious standard of review. They interpreted that in a way that almost made it less than rational basis, a lower standard than rational basis. In fact, you know, that there's lots of reason to think that standard of review in 1905 was a little stronger than what we think of as rational basis now. So they identified this standard of review in Jacobson that was an extremely low bar, and many, many, many lower courts picked that up and ran with it and essentially used it to avoid even articulating, you know, what the fundamental right in dispute might be in a case and a challenge to all sorts of measures extending well beyond the First Amendment context. I understand the majority to have rejected Jacobson as a suspension standard of review, at least for First Amendment claims. And you can also see this in dissents in the previous cases, Calvary Christian and South Bay, for specific justices. You can kind of count the votes. Several justices, though, have indicated that they might draw a line between the First Amendment and 14th Amendment in this regard. And so Gorsuch actually kind of sets himself up as allowing room for himself to adopt a Jacobson suspension standard, perhaps with regard to abortion restrictions, should those reach the court again, you know, emergency restrictions on abortion because of COVID. That 14th Amendment distinction matters because a lot of the challenges to, you know, the basic travel restrictions and stay-at-home orders are not on First Amendment grounds, but on 14th Amendment substantive due process grounds. I think there's at least some room for the court to continue the viability of the suspension doctrine. I think that would be unfortunate, though. I don't think that there's a strong basis for that suspension doctrine in the Jacobson opinion itself. And as Steve Laddick and I have written, it's problematic for other reasons as well. Fortunately, most restrictions have at some point been upheld by, you know, some number of federal court judges without resorting to the Jacobson suspension doctrine. And so mask requirements, stay-at-home orders, travel restrictions, closure of non-essential businesses, all of these provisions, you know, I went through carefully after over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend, all of these provisions have been upheld by at some point by at least some courts without relying on a Jacobson suspension standard. I expect courts will continue that trend and avoid relying on a Jacobson standard going forward. Now, there's a bigger question about what it means for compulsory vaccination as well, and we can speak to that more specifically. Gorsuch, interestingly, I think tries to set himself up as a potential swing vote on compulsory vaccination and on the question of whether there would need to be a religious exemption that would be constitutionally required, which the courts have generally found is not the case up to this point. So maybe we can discuss that a bit.
I think I agree most with everything Lindsay said, and I don't agree with Steve Laddick often, but I agree with Steve here as well. The courts have completely botched Jacobson. And I don't want to say this too lightly, but I think, Alan, you're saying too nice. I think judges have been lazy. I don't like saying it, but I will. I think judges said, oh my God, we have a pandemic. I don't want to get involved. I need some authority. Oh, good, Jacobson, that does it, right? And oh, good, John Roberts said something about Jacobson. I think it was really a failing of judging. If you actually read the opinion, it will become clear. It has no salience to these COVID cases other than the fact that we're dealing with a pandemic or maybe an epidemic. Lindsay can correct me. I never know the right standard, right? But the spread of a disease, right? It was unfortunate the judges made these errors because I think it really allowed governors to get away with stuff. And this is not just a right-left issue. In my home state of Texas, the governor decided that abortion was not an essential service. And this litigation went up and down for a few points. And I've criticized the Fifth Circuit's decision. The decision may be correct under the Casey Holman's health standard, but it's absolutely not relevant that Jacobson has anything to do with it. Just Jacobson says nothing about these issues. I think both liberal and conservative judges reach for a precedent from 1905 by John Marshall Harlan from the Lochner era. My goodness. to decide COVID cases as if nothing has happened in the last 115 years. I think that's a mistake. But I think now Jacobson's done. I think you saw the Sixth Circuit decision the other day in a case involving the Kentucky Attorney General. And they said, look, we're not relying on Jacobson anymore. Now, Lindsay makes a fair point. We know that the diocese case, we know that the diocese case is governed by the Free Exercise Clause. What about other cases that are not so clear? So cases involving restrictions on mask wearing, on gathering, on travel, right? On schools. Schools are not necessarily the same as worship. There are cases involving the Second Amendment where some cities are refusing to issue gun permits because of COVID-related backlogs. You know, there are a lot of other issues that are not clearly about the First Amendment. Perhaps, you know, when we're dealing with a substantive due process right, some sort of rational basis review does apply because we're not dealing with an enumerated right. But at least for enumerated rights, I think we have a much more rigid standard.
So I feel compelled to jump in here and defend Jacobson in the way that I understand Jacobson, which is not as a suspension standard of review. But what I understood Chief Justice Roberts to be saying and clarifying in his dissent in Roman Catholic Diocese is that he didn't cite Jacobson as a suspension standard, but that doesn't mean it has no salience here or that it's done. I think the Jacobson suspension standard is done, but Jacobson itself really speaks to the fact that in a balancing test, whatever that standard may be, public health necessities can outweigh individual rights. And we've seen federal courts in the last several months find exactly that without resorting to an interpretation of Jacobson as establishing a very low standard of review. So that basic principle of Jacobson, I think, continues to have a great deal of salience, even if the suspension standard may not.
So clearly there are a lot of unresolved questions here. I mean, it sounds like, you know, at the highest level, we can say that, you know, in this case, the court, at the very least, kind of fired a shot across the bow, signaling a real sensitivity towards, you know, religious freedoms and in particular the right of houses of worship to stay open, and that for the myriad of other COVID restrictions that may or may not implicate constitutional rights, we'll just sort of have to see how the lower courts and then the Supreme Court grapple with it. Lindsay and Josh, I want to thank you so much for joining me and sharing your insight.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've liked what you've heard, please take a moment to rate the podcast or let someone know so they can enjoy it as well. This podcast is produced by Jen Patya Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.